This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. The Tropical Rainforest Conservation and Research Centre, or TRCRC for short, was established in 2012 to restore tropical rainforests and address the critical rate of biodiversity loss in Malaysia. TRCRC's mission is twofold: to preserve tropical rainforest plant species and lead landscape-wide protection and reforestation projects throughout the country. So joining me now to shed more light on the work that they do and also to discuss a new project that they're working on called People for Pete is Dr. Lee Jo Kien, TRCRC's lead analyst. Welcome, Jo. How are you today?
I'm fine. Hi, Juliet.
Thank you so much for joining us. So, you know, for anyone who's unfamiliar, can you remind us about the work done by the Tropical Rainforest Conservation and Research Centre?
Sure thing. So when TRCRC started, the focus was the conservation of endangered tree species. And for Malaysia, that would be the family of trees called the dipterocarps. They make up the biggest, tallest trees in the tropical rainforest in this region. There are about 200 or so species in Malaysia and the region, and about 50% of that in Malaysia are red listed by the IUCN. So what TRCRC does is we decided to do a conservation program for these trees by doing tropical rainforest living collections, our flagship program. The reason we need to do a living collection of living trees standing is because they can't actually be frozen in seed banks like other seeds. The seeds of the dipterocarps are unfortunately recalcitrant, which means if you try to freeze them and then try to revive them, they don't grow. They're not viable anymore.
Mm.
And unfortunately, they only flower, most of the species only flower once in about 5 to 7 years.
Oh.
So it's like, you know, the odds are stacked against the dipterocarps, but that's what TRCRC is here to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had two of these such TRLCs for short, Tropical Rainforest Living Collections. One in Sabah, which we established about the time we started the organization. And the second one in Amanjaya, Perak. The first one being 220 hectares. Second one's about 500 hectares.
Sure. But and you know, how has that like you said, it's a flagship program, right? How has that been going? It's been about how many years now? 8 years, I would say?
Yeah, somewhere around there. It's a lot further ahead in Sabah because it's had more time to develop. So the first 5 years or so, it's really establishing the nursery, trying to get some seed stocks because, as I've mentioned, they only flower once in 5 to 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
So if you happen to start the living collection at a time where, you know, mass fruiting just happened and you missed it, you're just going to have to wait for the next mass fruiting to happen for these dipterocarps before you can collect again.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to make sure the schedules align, you've got funding to make, to, you know, collect as much as you can. And that's, I mean, that's just really important to for us to stock the seed stocks in TRLCs.
Mm-hmm. And so the stars really need to be aligned for everything to kind of work in that sense.
Yeah. So, you know, that has to happen along with funding cycles and also for everything else, just even the logistics of it, to have like water supply to the nursery, it has to be constant. You know, it can't be blocked out one day and then the next day, oh no, the elephant broke our pipe again, you know. That has happened a couple of times.
Things you don't hear in a regular office, you know, the disruptions.
These guys actually dig out pipes from underground.
They
do some pretty funny stuff. We put out a fake pipe because we knew they liked to play with it.
Oh,
and then after that, it found the real pipe and went for it.
They're too clever. Like you cannot trick them. But what is, I suppose, the main aim for this? And, you know, what is like a success story that you could share from this program?
Okay. I think the most marked success story we had was this species called Vetica cantanensis. It's an endemic species that's found in Kantan specifically and nowhere else.
Mm.
And in the wild, there was only about 50 individuals known when it was discovered. So when we came in, we worked with a corporate company and they funded a nursery which they will take over. We just had to train them. And now we've collected about 1,000 seedlings. So that's like a huge multiplication in terms of how many individuals there are. So that will be, I guess, the biggest success story. But we've also got like some tens of thousands of seedlings in both of our living collections.
That's amazing. And, you know, what is that whole process of going into the forest and searching for these seedlings? You know, I mean, that must be quite an epic thing on its own.
Yeah, this is best done on video, but, you know, I'll try my best with words. So the first thing is you got to be in touch with locals on the ground, whether it be the forestry departments, local forestry departments, or just other eyes and ears that could watch out for flowering that's taking place. in mass fruiting years, what we do is when we start to see that there's some flowering taking place, then we got to have a sort of recce trip to find out what stage of flowering are they at, so that we could project how long we have before we have to come back to collect from these trees that are beginning to flower.
Mm.
So that process alone can take 6 months.
Wow.
From, you know, looking at when it starts to flower, show signs of fruiting, before we actually come back. And, you know, you have to come back just on time. If they fall like 1-2 weeks, we might be late and we have to collect seedlings on the ground instead. We call them wildings.
Mm-hmm.
So that takes a bit more work. But it depends on the species. Some species is actually better to collect wildings, and some it's like we have to shake them off the tree if we're there just on time. So that's when we use the big shot and you shoot this giant slingshot and actually shake the tree branches to make them drop. It's a pretty epic job.
Yeah. I hope there are videos somewhere that we can see all of this happening.
There are.
Okay, excellent. So that's the Tropical Rainforest Living Collection. Another program that you guys do also is called Forest the New Economy. I think that's a reforestation initiative.
I wouldn't put it that way. I'd say that Forest the New Economy is actually a program that looks at trying to implement and finding sustainable models for land use.
Mm-hmm.
So many of our land use models currently are based on a single species model, like oil palm plantations. It's huge plantations with one species and very, very little biodiversity.
Monocultures.
Yep, mm-hmm. Exactly. So FNE basically, in short, is trying to look for different models that could improve biodiversity on cultivated lands and also to maximize the productivity of abandoned lands, because I think we have a lot of abandoned lands lying around that's just not productive and growing weeds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if that is that potential is to be harnessed, it also reduces the amount of pressure on forested lands to be converted.
Mm-hmm.
They just need to be found out, and you know, business plans need to be produced for them, developed for them. Cost benefit analysis has been done, but yeah, because these things can be so different for different kinds of lands and ecosystems, so that thing itself is a huge opportunity and a huge undertaking.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the projects that you've done, you know, under this initiative?
It's mostly been exploratory. A lot of different proposals out of it. But you could say that what we're doing currently with EU, the super project that we're going to talk about later, People for Peat, that's actually, you could say, the peat version of Forest New Economy. Because Forest New Economy is like an umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
It goes from forested lands to pristine lands to all kinds of ecosystems. But with Supa, it's a lot more focused on just peat lands.
Okay, all right. And like you said, we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But one other thing that we wanted to talk about also is the Central Forest Spine project that you are also part of.
Yeah, so prior to my role as a lead analyst with People for Peat, what I used to do was actually head out the team that did the work with Central Forest Spine,
mm-hmm.
in restoration and all that. So what we did, because Central Forest Spine was actually a federal master plan to basically create contiguous forests from Penang all the way to Singapore. I remember Dr. Bala mentioning that.
Yes.
Yes. And then what happened, of course, was a different story. It's really hard for different landowners to come together and agree to create that sort of connectivity, because the landowners may not be in agreement, maybe, mm-hmm. you know, interests were not taken into account. So what we came in as TRCRC was, when we got a grant from Yayasan Hassanah in 2017 and 18, we actually met stakeholders on the ground around these central forest spine linkages, where there are kind of known hotspots for these connections and for wildlife corridors as well. And we spoke to all the stakeholders we can muster in the area, from the landowners to government regulatory bodies to other NGOs in the ground, to see what kind of areas are there available for restoration in linkages especially.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did was we used the IUCN Rome Restoration Opportunity Assessment Methods. We used that methodology to characterize what level of degradation, how much is required to restore these areas to become stable forest ecosystems. And we characterize as many as we can within Central Forest Spine 1, which is the upper half of the peninsula.
Mm-hmm. And how is that project going? I mean, it sounds like there is a lot of, I guess there's a lot of hiccups that could happen along the way, I suppose.
Yeah, I think one main thing that we face in Peninsula Malaysia is that every state has a different regulatory body.
Mm.
And if you look at Sabah and Sarawak, it's huge landmass, but it's just one body,
mm-hmm.
that really, you know, oversees the entire thing. Whereas if you were to do a project in Malaysia, West Malaysia, that focuses on restoration, you can be looking at, you know, a small plot in Perak, another plot in Kelantan, and another one in Terengganu, and then have to do with three sets of stakeholders, each one having a different priority, each one having different thoughts in their mind. So it does get a bit complicated. It's very engagement intensive. Mm-hmm. And also because offices in the government are generally loaded with a lot of administrative work, mm-hmm. it's hard to get meetings to happen sometimes.
Oh dear. And I guess there's also different regulations for everything. So you also need to be aware of all the different laws and regulations that are in place for each different, under each different state government as well.
Yeah, generally, I think the National Forestry Act will be the main one that we have to refer to. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, we actually find out more during engagements with these ministries and agencies. So whatever we don't understand or whatever we're proposing, we actually run it through the forestry departments and see what they say, whether these are allowable, whether these are something they've already tried. And I think that's good because it creates that understanding between both parties that this is what we actually want to do and we're being very transparent about it. Mm-hmm. So that builds trust.
Mm. And I guess, based on what you're saying, dialogue is very forthcoming. So they are open to these sorts of engagement and getting all the different stakeholders involved as well.
Well, I wouldn't say it's easy to get all the stakeholders involved, especially private landowners. I think it's been hard to even find who the private landowners are sometimes, but when we do, it's hard to get them to show up to stakeholder engagements. There's been some efforts by some state forestries that tried to gather landowners from CFS linkages to come together to talk about it. Mm. But sometimes nobody shows up, just us and the government departments. And it's rather sad because they own the majority of the land within the linkages. Mm-hmm. And if you can't get them to agree to anything, I mean, it may not even be to give up the entire concession or something, just create some corridors for crossing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, people just won't show up, so we don't know how to go about that.
Okay, so that's an ongoing struggle, I suppose. That's an ongoing challenge.
Yep.
Tell me a little bit about the G-Team program. What is that all about?
Right, so the G-Team program is it's a 9-month program that TRCRC works together with SMP, Secretariat Malaysia Prihatin. What we do is we actually identify disadvantaged youths who have dropped out of high school, and we get in touch to see if they're willing to be part of this 9-month program where they train as amateur foresters. So it's entirely sponsored. They get a stipend to live in and place provided. And by the end of it, they are usually good enough to be very excellent tree identifiers. I mean, to identify a Dipterocarpus species is not easy. Mm-hmm. And these guys, they are all pretty up to the task. I mean, I do some plants. I can identify some plants, but Dipterocarpus are another story, man.
Really?
So they're really good. And what I also want to put out there is also the Anak Pokok short film that won, I think, an award in the South and Southwest Festival. Mm-hmm. So that was produced by heavily involved by one of our former videographers in TRCRC. His name is Shannon. So that was a pretty interesting film, I think, that really inspired many to... I mean, it's not just those who have degrees and PhDs that should be involved in conservation.
Of course not, yeah.
Yeah, so it's nice to see that people who dropped out of school, who managed to enroll in this program, that could see meaning in the kind of work that they're doing. And I really think that that's one of the things I'm most proud of in the organization.
That's wonderful. And when you say it's a 9-month program, that means it's once it's done, or this is an ongoing, every cycle is 9 months?
Every cycle is 9 months. So what we need to be very mindful of is employment post-program. Mm. So every time we do take a cohort, we have to make sure that there is at least funding to keep them or find them employment somewhere. We try to guarantee employment by the end of the program. Mm-hmm. And so far, it's been all right. And we've had them in our Perak Center. We've had them in our other KL office as well, watching over our nursery. They're basically the guys that do seed collection, identify the trees, do the data trail from the point of collection and identifying the trees and bringing them back. So they know everything about how to conserve the Dipterocarps, how to take them out of the forest without killing the seeds and killing the seedlings when you pull them off the ground. And honestly, if you left this to the team in the office, we'd probably all fail.
Oh,
Zaiman aside, obviously.
All right. Well, he's a different one, isn't he?
Yeah, he's special.
So it's one. So then you guys are training them, and then hopefully they will also start training others coming after them. Is that how it works?
Yeah, some of them have actually progressed to become the supervisors of the team, and some of them are more focused on training people at the training site itself when we run the program. But all in all, mostly when they're not doing the training program, they're actually taking care of all the seedlings and planning seed collection the next mass rooting time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I understand that you guys are also doing an Orang Asli outreach program. Am I correct? Could you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, so the Orang Asli outreach that we're doing in Belum Rainforest up in the north, is actually focused on trying to involve indigenous peoples in conservation. Mm. And how this happens is actually we scope out where they're living, first of all, the villages. We've identified the villages within that landscape in Belum. And we've engaged with about 17 different villages. But for the first phase of the project, we've only gotten, I think, 2 villages involved directly. So what they do is they identify where our tree species of interest are once we've communicated that to them, show them samples, and they actually know where these trees are because they live there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they would actually monitor when they're flowering and seeding, and they actually then do the collection. And what we do is we come in after they've done these collections, and we mark where these mother trees are to make sure we know their genetics,
mm-hmm.
so we don't, you know, it's not a, we know it's a roadside tree or it's in the middle of the forest, and we can characterize it that way. And then we buy these seedlings off them. For now, it's using grant money for the program. And in the future, what we plan to do is create this offtake program where the Orang Asli themselves actually will create their own seed plots and nurseries. We will train them to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And this offtake program will then become a side income for them as they continue to do different collections for different species that will then be channeled to forest restoration programs in the peninsula.
That's wonderful. And I mean, what has the collaboration been like? You know, have they been quite forthcoming, you know, or interested in this as well?
Absolutely. They were skeptical at first, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a very communal setting in Orang Asli villages. And once they see a couple of individuals involved who are benefiting from it, who are making money, who are actually doing well, they would then see that they could do the same. And they're much more inclined then, since that trust has been built, to be involved.
Mm-hmm.
And we start to see more and more interest picking up. The ones who are already involved in the program so far have been, I think you could say, overperforming.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an outcome we want.
Yes, we do. But yeah, since now, we really got to work on getting that offtake program going so that there will be off-takers that will buy these seedlings off.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably the next phase of the program.
Okay, all right. I'm speaking today to Dr. Lee Jokian. He is the lead analyst for the People for Peat program under the Tropical Rainforest Conservation and Research Center. And we're discussing the work that TRCRC does. And we're also going to focus after this quick break on the People for Peat program. So stay tuned. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me in the studio today is Dr. Lee Jokian. He is the lead analyst for People for Peat at the Tropical Rainforest Conservation and Research Center, or TRCRC for short. And we're discussing the work that the organization does, and also we're going to find out more about this new project that they're working on. So, Joe, it's called People for Peat, and it's part of a coalition as well, right? That also includes the World Resources Institute, WRI, and Yayasan Initiative Dagang Hijau. So together, you were awarded a European Union-funded grant for the sustainable use of peatland management and haze mitigation in ASEAN, or the SUPER program. So tell me, what is this all about?
Yeah, so the SUPER program is really focused on haze mitigation, like you mentioned in the title. And I'm glad they chose to take that angle because it's a lot more relatable to the layman. Because there are a lot of other issues with peatlands, with land subsidence, with carbon emissions. That's like a gigaton of carbon coming out from global peatlands annually. And all of those might be a bit maybe harder to connect for the layman. So for transboundary haze, which is something that every Malaysian experiences on an annual basis.
Unfortunately.
Is something that we could all relate to, I think. Mm-hmm. So let's get into the grant a bit. The grant has two components, the first one being the state actors component. Component one is implemented by GIZ. And what they do is basically to talk to different governments and state agencies to see what can be done on their level mm-hmm. to make land use and land management in peatlands more sustainable to reduce haze occurrences. And component two, which is what People for Peat is about, focuses on the non-state actors, everything non-governmental. But of course, being regulatory bodies, we can't skip government bodies. So that would be lawless.
Yeah.
So we do have to engage with government bodies at some capacity.
Mm-hmm. And before we get into the grant itself, you know, you did talk about peatlands and maybe, you know, maybe it will help people to understand, you know, what peatlands are, you know, why is it so important, you know, why degraded or damaged peatlands are so dangerous. Maybe you can just kind of spell that out as well.
Sure thing. So peat is basically undecomposed or semi-decomposed plant matter that is accumulated. And in places like Southeast Asia, the dominant kind of peatland we have is tropical peat swamp forests. They're flooded all the time or at least seasonally. Mm-hmm. And why peat forms is because of the kind of conditions that are actually occurring in these peatlands. So peatlands are places where water tends to accumulate, flooded conditions all the time. And so all the plant matter that falls in generally doesn't decompose very much and accumulates over thousands of years to form these structures called peat domes. Mm. And it's on these peat domes that the peat swamp forests actually occur. So they have comparable above ground biomass, which is to say like trees and plants and all that, to a regular lowland rainforest, which is already high. But they also store a lot of carbon in that peat that's undecomposed. And what happens to this carbon when you drain it for plantations or you drain it for conversion? It's a couple of different things. The first one, of course, is all that carbon stored up over thousands of years is suddenly free to just be liberated into carbon dioxide.
Oh, dear.
So, but that's not the only problem. That is the climate change aspect of it. Second thing is also land subsidence. So in the first year, some studies have said that you could expect a drained tropical peatland to subside by 75 centimetres from the surface. Within the first 5 years, about 142 centimetres. And there's been a study done in the Rajang Delta, that is the area of about 850,000 hectares. Within the next 25 years, we're going to see about 40% of the land underwater.
Oh, wow.
So that is a conservative estimate. The actual number is probably going to be higher.
So what would that mean then? You know, what are the consequences of that?
I think the most affected, as per every environmental disaster, would be people living in these localities. So for people living within the Rajang Delta, you could expect places where they used to farm to be non-arable anymore because saltwater intrusion is going to make the land non-arable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And not just that, but places that you stay are also going to be underwater. So that's going to be obviously an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So people will have to be moved out of there and loss of income will be an issue. Yeah. So when you drain what used to be a wet peat swamp, now you have a layer of peat that's basically fuel for burning mm-hmm. that's just exposed, which could actually spontaneously catch fire. So it isn't always somebody, an evil farmer, trying to set the place on fire.
Yeah.
And yeah, when it does, unfortunately, it just burns for months. It doesn't stop by you pouring water over it easily because it burns underground.
Mm.
And so what tends to happen is when it starts burning, you get haze coming out from these areas. This is the primary cause of transboundary haze in ASEAN.
And that's intense. And we all know, we've all experienced it, and we know how devastating and the trickle-down effects from that itself, you know, the health issues, the, you know, how it impacts society, how it impacts incomes as well, you know, when people can't go to their work if they're sick. So there's so many different sort of, repercussions from it.
I think another angle on this unfortunate angle is also that with COVID-19 being a respiratory issue and hay season being just around the corner, this is of utmost importance that we try to suppress peat fires from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, that is apparently what the Indonesian government is trying to do. They've declared an emergency in the most peat fire-prone areas, even before major fires has broken out. I think there already has been some fires, but it's probably still under control. Mm-hmm. So let's hope that doesn't break out into full-force peat fires.
We've been seeing some rather alarming, I guess, headlines saying that, you know, yeah, the haze is coming back anytime now. You know, the fires are raging in Indonesia. I mean, is that, would you know if that's the case?
Well, there has been about 700 fires reported, mm-hmm. but at what scale these fires are burning, I have no idea.
Okay.
I only saw them from the satellites, so it's just dots on a map.
Okay, all right. So I guess time will tell. But again, okay, this is where this program comes in. Again, you know, what are the ultimate goals for this collaboration? You know, what are some areas of collaboration that you guys are looking at as well?
So component two for People for Peat has three main pillars, the first one being research and data. Second one is the business hub. And the third one is on awareness for peatlands and mm-hmm. communications. Mm-hmm. So the first pillar will actually be headed out by WRI, being the World Research Institute. So what that does is basically to put together all the existing work and literature on peatland to one sort of one-stop center where everyone can access. Because what's been happening in the past 10 to 20 years is pockets of different research and projects on peatlands have been happening, but no one has really brought them all together to compile them in one place and hopefully get that place running, you know, thereafter so that people can come to it to actually get information that's relevant. So you do see some level of duplication in work when you go back to look at these different initiatives. And we hope that Pillar 1 will be able to sort of consolidate everything and actually let everyone be on the same page when we come together to look at, say, the online portal. We'll be able to access that information and it wouldn't have to be a wild goose chase. Mm-hmm. So that's Pillar 1. Pillar 2 is probably one of the pillars that TRCRC is heading out. It's actually what I would say is one of the more challenging pillars, because what it plans to do is we're going to do a business hub that basically does business acceleration for businesses and organizations that are trying to implement sustainable land management models mm-hmm. for their businesses to also at the same time not lose profit while doing it.
Yeah.
So what we do is basically we try to get experts, known experts and consultants to help these people, these organizations to produce a proposal that's up to par to qualify for that funding. We fund those consultants that help them with the proposals. Mm-hmm. And then if they win the competition, they become part of our cohort, which will then receive even more technical assistance, which will take shape in the form of people going on the ground for them, sending experts in to help them to see what are the best business models that could help you in your place. Because how you manage a piece of land, peatland specifically, in the locality that you're in will also depend on what culture there is behind there. Are these people okay with fishing? Because some cultures are not.
Yeah.
Are they okay with non-timber forest product collection? Some we don't know what works for the particular locality. So we got to get all that information down. Got to know what are the possible solutions for the area. So once we've gotten that, done the numbers, crunched them all out, then we could see, is this a viable case for us to actually do anything about? So we want to create as many success stories as we can. And from there, hopefully, we'll have more adoption from other parties who see that this can be done. And ideally, we want to see peatlands being no longer drained.
Yeah.
Because I think with some of the legislation that's going on, even in RSPO, is like there's an allowance for a 40-centimeter water table depth from the surface, and that's not ideal either. Mm. So what we would like to see happening more is paleoculture, where you actually cultivate things in a fully flooded condition. So you don't actually flood the peatlands. Things like sago can be cultivated in these conditions. So we've got to explore that more. And also at the same time, not lose sight that, you know, it has to be competitive in comparison to other crops that are on these kind of areas right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I guess you're looking for different solutions and there's no one-size-fits-all in that sense, right?
Exactly. Oh, I think it also needs to be said that we're not encouraging businesses to open more peatlands. That's not the plan. What we want to do is to look at existing businesses on peatlands and try to make them more sustainable and not to encourage everyone to start, you know, converting peatlands to businesses.
Yeah. Okay, that's going to be a tough one. But you are looking for collaborations as well, right? I mean, the project is fairly new, am I correct? Yeah, tell me about it.
Actively looking indeed. Mm. So when we started sort of getting active in November 2019, things were actually taking shape. We were beginning to meet partners and potential partners in different countries, traveling, and then COVID-19 came.
Of course.
Everything ground to a halt. So everything since March has been virtual, and it's also been like desktop research, a lot of consolidating information. I can't say it's been bad, honestly, because partners have been very receptive to virtual discussions that we've had. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say that it has gone completely off tangent, but I would say that, yeah, we do miss meeting people in a place of their comfort.
Right.
And actually, you know, getting to know them better.
Yeah, making that sales pitch in person as such, right?
It's, yes.
It makes a, you know, world of difference. But you are actively looking, I mean, who are you looking for to, you know, who are you looking for and what's the best way to do that?
I think most, the hardest people to find or the hardest stakeholders to identify are people who are willing to fund these projects. Because what we do in the Business Hub is really to give them seed funding to get a viable business case. Mm. And from there, we still need to help them secure funding for the long term to make the business actually more sustainable. So if there are like agricultural funds, if there are sustainable funding available, outside of those that are already linked to IDH, of course, because they are working very closely with quite a number of them, mm-hmm. we would be very happy to get in touch, especially for smallholders. Mm-hmm. And that is ASEAN-wide, not just within Malaysia. Mm-hmm. I also need to mention that it's the SUPA program here focuses on 8 of the ASEAN member states, excluding Brunei and Singapore.
Okay, all right. And what is the time frame for this project? Is there a time frame? And, you know, what would success look like?
So it's 3 years from the time we started. And to me, what success would look like is actually investments capitalized into these businesses that goes through our business hub. Mm-hmm. So that's pillar 2 I'm still talking about, that we hope to have some success cases where peatland businesses are able to, you know, improve peatland management practices, reduce draining or eliminate draining altogether, and be able to say that they're still making a fair, you know, decent income from it. Mm. And able to inspire others to do the same. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there's also pillar 3, which I have not gotten to at all.
Tell me, what is pillar 3?
Pillar 3 is about awareness about peat swarm issues. And I think the main focus of this would be the local communities that live within these peatlands or around these peatlands. So many people in ASEAN don't actually know that they're living on peatlands. They don't know the significance of it. Sometimes there is not even a name to describe peatlands. And this is important because we don't want to come in and prescribe what a peatland is to people there.
Yeah.
So when we talked with our communications and stakeholder management manager, Mariam, she will usually focus on having a locally derived source, a locally derived narrative. Mm-hmm. So that requires us to engage with these locals from different places in ASEAN to be able to get that information and put it in a locally digestible context. Mm-hmm. And for that, there is a component within the grant that actually hires a country coordinator for each of the 6 countries other than Malaysia and Indonesia, because that's where our partners are. Right. So these country coordinators will interface between the People for Peat team and also local NGOs and local communities. So whatever communications material, whatever social media we want to put out, we will bounce it with them to make it published in the local language in a locally acceptable, understandable context so that it actually is impactful.
Mm-hmm. And that's really important. I mean, you know, who wants some strangers coming in and telling them what to do, basically, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And what else would you like the public to know about this project? You know, how can they get involved, if at all?
Well, you can follow us on People for Peat Facebook and Instagram for a start.
Okay.
Our website is still on the way, but come August, I think we'll have our first conference of parties that will be open to all invited members. And we hope to be able to showcase what's been going on in different ASEAN countries so that we kind of have a baseline of what needs to be done, what is existing, what are the gaps. Mm. So from there, we'll identify research gaps, we'll identify gaps maybe in management or regulatory bodies, and hopefully with that, come up with some recommendations that we can act on more concretely. Mm-hmm. So that's first COP is going to be stock-taking.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It's, I mean, and that's important, right? I mean, to see where you are and then to see how best to move forward in the whole project as well.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, any last message that you'd like to leave us with?
Well, maybe not related to peatlands, but with regards to this project specifically, I'd say that we don't intend to, we don't think within this 3 years you're going to solve all the issues, mm-hmm. but we do want to create examples that people can follow after. Mm-hmm. And if you know anyone who could relate to this project or could be useful for this project, please send them our way.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Dr. Lee Jokien. He is the lead analyst for the People for Peat program at the Tropical Rainforest Conservation and Research Center, or TRCRC. If you'd like to find out more information, you can visit their website at trcrc.org, or you can find them on Facebook and Instagram. If you miss any part of this interview or any previous Earth Matters interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.